Today, KGAL's Valley Talk comes to you on location from the famous Monteith House in downtown Albany, right across from the post office, 518 2nd Avenue Southwest. This was the first stick-built home in Albany. It's in wonderful condition, and we're going to take a radio virtual tour of the Monteith House today. With me today is Chet Hauser, who is the board president of the Monteith Historical Society. Welcome, Chet.
Well, welcome. Thank you for coming here to the Monteith House. We're thrilled to have the radio station here. I wanted to start out here on the front steps just to give people a feel for it. And as you said, we're directly across from the post office. We're always amazed at how many people have lived in Albany for years and years and never even knew we were here. And our visiting hours and things are posted right on the fence posts out front. So if you have any questions, you want to know who to call or when we're open. We currently have a docent here Wednesday through Saturday from 12 to 4.
Tell us what a docent is.
A docent is a person who's going to take you around the house and explain everything. So if you forget anything we say today, you can just come on by. It's a great family activity, a great thing for reunions, and a good time to come on by and see us.
So we're right outside the front door of the Monteith House, standing on the porch. With us today as well, and joining us later on the program, will be Patty Evans, who's another board member with the Monteith Historical Society, John Langford, who functions as the blacksmith for the Monteith House, and he'll tell us more about that coming up, and Rebecca Bond is also here, the Historic Resources Coordinator with the Albany Visitors Association, and our own Mary Eads, co-owner of KGAL KSHO Radio, is with us, and so you may be hearing her involvement in the conversation as we go along. But right now, it's just me and Chet Hauser standing out in front of the Monteith House, and I'll just let you take it away from here, Chet.
Well, two brothers, Thomas and Walter Monteith, back in 1847, leave Illinois. They spend 2 weeks in Iowa. Thomas falls madly in love with Christine Dunbar, wants to marry her and take off for Oregon. And Dad says, no way. You go out to Oregon and establish yourself, make a life, and then come back. So here's this 15-year-old girl left in Iowa, pining for Thomas. And you'll have to come to the house to hear the rest of the story. And how Christine ever made it to Oregon. It's quite a story in itself.
She did make it? You can tell us that much?
I can tell you that much. She did out here, and it was quite a trip. So, as Jeff said, this is a stick-built house. It's the lumber you would get if you went to one of our Lowe's or our Home Depot. Before that time, everybody had log cabins. We know from some of the diaries and an interview with a granddaughter in a historical version of 1948, they interviewed her, and she said, oh, yeah, Grandma and Grandpa got their lumber from a mill out in Jefferson. So it's fascinating to think there was a water-driven mill in 1848 out there on the Santa Ana River. So with that, let's go ahead and go on inside the house.
And the first thing you notice as you come in to the Monteith House is there's no electricity going on in here.
Yeah, in fact, Albany didn't get electricity until about 1889, 88. And the interesting thing is it came off the canal. The canal was finished about 1873.
That's the canal that goes from Lebanon to Albany.
Yeah, 14 miles, and I think it's a 27-foot drop for those that are physics people. We had quite a bit of water pressure. And we try to talk to people when they come to the house about what it meant to Albany. We had about 28 factories that were working off of that canal system all over Albany. In fact, if you go to Jefferson Street today, you can see the remains of, or Jackson Street, you can see the remains of that canal. As well, of course, as 8th Street, where the ducks are at. And that was part of a very important industrial might for the city of Albany. Well, let's go ahead and go into the store.
We're going to the right now, just off the entrance.
The Monteiths wanted to start a town. Well, to have a town in that era, you had to have a store. So here you are, you're building this house, beautiful house at the time, lumber and everything, but they had to convert one of the rooms into a store. Anything you needed in that era, you could have come in here in terms of dry goods. Now, it's interesting, the meat market was down where Novak's is today, and they're actually going to get a carved head of a bull to put out there on the front, which we have pictures of, but it was lost a long time ago. But they have done a great job of restoring their building to the historical accuracy of the time.
So when you go into Novak's to enjoy a wonderful Hungarian meal, you're sitting in a building that looks just like it did back in the day.
As much as they could do that, yes. Yeah, very good. In fact, the Monteith House is the most historically accurate historical house in the state of Oregon. When I have a contractor come in to help redo things, so windows and sashes, we use square nails, we use old virgin timber that where we can. Everything is done as much as we can. Where you can see things, they're done historically correctly.
You know, I'm looking at these beautiful floors. What's original in this room?
You are walking on the original floor.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Perfect condition.
Well, it was preserved because the Monteiths, once they got selling city lots and everything, had the money that they could put carpet or, you know, rugs down. You see a rag rug right here, and that was the thing you did in that era. Wool stands up to walking on it. We've had these rugs here for as many as 20 and 30 years.
Amazing.
We opened up as a museum in 1981, and some of these rugs are the same ones. We flipped them over, but basically a rag rug that your grandmother would have had in her home for warmth. And so it covered up these. And then, of course, there was a time where it was a boarding house. They put a linoleum down on the floor.
Oh, my goodness.
When we took over the house, it was a wreck in about 1971. A great historical revival going on in America. Let's save the buildings and not have them destroyed. It took us about 10 years to get the house restored back. But in the process, they lifted up all that linoleum, and lo and behold, here's the original floors.
Isn't that wonderful?
When you go upstairs, Patty Evans will talk to you about some of the wallpaper and some of the other things that we discovered that had been covered up with drywall and things. So it's a fascinating thing historical preservation, fascinating things to come to the house and see what your grandmother or great-grandmother, you know, what was her life been like, and how would she have decorated her house to make it bearable, you know?
So along with not only the structure of the building, but the items in the house, are most of them original to the house then?
We've tried to maintain original items as much as we can, and I just have to really commend the Monteith family. They just preserved an awful lot of things. We have a lot of furniture here through that family. We got some from the Burkhart family, which was an early pioneer family that was here, and then some other pioneer families that held on to things. And when we opened, we were willing to take just about anything that we could get. We're currently in the process of trying to raise funds to recover some of the chairs and sofa and things. And we also try to get funds. We got a grant to do some of the historical documentation. So it's the kind of thing that we have a committee. We look at items. We make sure they're historically accurate for the time, and we make sure they fit in with the overall goal and mission of our house, which is preserve what it was like for a pioneer family and help explain what life was like for the visitors as they come through the house.
You're listening to Valley Talk on KGAL. We're coming directly from the historic Monteith House on 2nd Avenue Southwest in downtown Albany, right across from the post office. And at this point in the broadcast, we're enjoying Chet Hauser, the board president of the Monteith Historical Society, as he tells us about, right now, the store that is located just to the right of the entrance as you come in.
Right. So in the store here, you see many of the items that you would have been able to purchase. Just want to point out this, what looks like a whiskey keg here. That keg is what flour would have been put in. The Monteiths in 1851 opened up the Magnolia Mill. Believe it or not, there were lots of people here in the Willamette Valley, and when they got here in 1847, 49, first of all, you had Native Americans here, but you had farmers that were out here farming wheat. Well, you needed a place to mill it. So the Monteiths opened up the Magnolia Mill, which, by the way, was right over here on the Calipooya River, and you can still see some of the concrete work and things because they dammed up the Calapooya River. They had a race, it's called a race, came off of that to drive the water mill, the grist mill, if you will, to grind the grain, which was then put on the Multnomah flat-bottom steamboat, paddle wheeler, and that was taken down to Oregon City. And of course, they have waterfalls there, so they unloaded that. We helped feed the city of Portland, Oregon, but we also have diary and invoices where we shipped our wheat to China and all over the world. So fascinating thing, little old Albany, and here we go. It's interesting how you get some of these facts. We were doing a tour last summer, and a fellow came in and said, yeah, his great-great-grandfather was here, and he couldn't understand why the Monteiths would want to build their house here on 2nd and Washington, because that area was a muddy area and subject to flooding. Well, if you know anything about the city of Albany, there was a time when all of First Street was underwater. Mm-hmm. So just interesting how you hear some of these stories, and, well, I bet you didn't know. So I do encourage people to come. The store is just filled with interesting items. We don't have time today, and it's kind of hard to describe every item. But I really encourage people to come and see. We have the prices on what things cost. In 1848, 1860, a carpenter was a skilled carpenter made $1.50 a day. And you can see on the chart here, his axe would have cost him $3.50. A pound of bacon was 25 cents. Lead for the shotgun and things. And all these items cost quite a bit of money. And it's funny because some of the diary entries, people were complaining about having to pay for a carpenter for $1.50. So things don't change any. We just change the dollar.
Look at how much the axe cost.
You can imagine why. Yeah.
That's a couple days pay there just to.
So is this a fairly accurate list of the types of things that would have been available in this store?
It is. We have diary entries. We have invoices. It's amazing how many things were retained and held on to. And then we also had the University of Oregon, the archaeology department came in and we had some studies done. And I think somebody actually did a master's thesis or something on research on it. So let's go ahead and go into the parlor. There are a couple things
Absolutely.
I want to say about that.
Okay. Well, could I ask you real quick, Chet, about this document? The first time I was here, first time I visited, I saw this. And it's actually signed by President Abraham Lincoln, who was the president at the time that this home was built, or not long after. Let's see, what was the year? It was 1848, so it would have been in the 1860s that he was president. Tell me about this document here.
Well, he actually signed it in February, and he was assassinated 2 months later in April. Appomattox, of course, was where the two generals met and ended the Civil War. I think that was about April 14th, and I think he was assassinated on the 17th. So it's a very timely document. What it is an extension, a land grant, if you will, of 320 acres to Walter Monteith. And we have the original maps going back to, I'm trying to think of the name of, there's a series of maps about 1878, and it shows what's the first and second additions to the Monteith land claim. So, we've all debated, was it actually the president? I think they probably had an aide sign for him. But the fact remains, it's an actual document we keep in the bank vault to show how the land grant was approved, and the city of Albany grew out of that. There were a couple of extensions on that. This same map shows the Hackleman extensions and where they had a couple of extensions to. What we call the downtown Albany area basically will say from Main Street over to Elm Street, from the river to Queen Avenue was all part of that era of city expansion with some of those early pioneer families, the Hacklemans particularly and the Monteiths.
Very good. Thank you, Chet. All right, so now we're in, I guess, what I would call a living room.
Well, it's the former parlor.
The parlor.
And in fact,
we have to get our etiquette right, Jack.
Not only that, but we try to make it formal. It's P-A-R-L-O-U-R.
Ah.
And in the December area, we have parlor tours. And historic homes open up, and we go in and see the decorations for Christmas and everything. But we pretty well focus on the parlors. Of course, this is a good time to talk about the home tour we have coming up with the historic homes and everything on July 29th. And I really encourage people to get a hold of the AVA, the Albany Visitors Association, and get their tickets. It's a fascinating time to go out and see the Monteith House as well as your Victorian era homes. So we're now standing in the parlor. This is the room that Thomas and Walter Monteith started the Republican Party for the city of Albany and I think for part of Oregon. It's also the room where they met with five different ministers to start five different church congregations. They also, in terms of civic responsibility, donated land for the post office. If you go down 2nd Street, you can see that strange building with the big columns out in front. That was land donated by the Monteiths. Where the courthouse is today, the Monteiths gave land to open the courthouse. So they were very civic-minded. They wanted to get a city that was civilized and had all of the things you needed for a city of that era. So when they come into the house, we bring them into the parlor, and like I say, in the Christmas time, there will be a Christmas tree here and decorated. We have kids come in and make authentic decorations that would have been made in 1860 era. So with that, let's go ahead and take you into the kitchen, and we have a pioneer mountain man who is a the kids love him. I mean, when we ask him what they remember about the Monteith House, it's usually his pioneer era shotgun or rifle, a muzzle loader, and he's a blacksmith by trade. So let's go ahead and let me take you in and introduce you to John Langford.
He looks quite imposing standing in there. I'm a little bit worried about coming into the into the room with him. Yeah. Okay. Well, hello, John. Thanks for being with us.
How are you today?
Very good. Very good.
I'm headed toward Hungary again.
Are you?
Yeah.
I'm generally on the way towards that myself, as a matter of fact.
Okay, this is the kitchen. Basically, this is the heart of the house where Mom spent most of her time because everything was made by scratch. You didn't go to McDonald's. You didn't go get a bunch of some Jiffy mix or something like that to make biscuits with. You got the materials together and built them.
Now, I don't see any appliances or things
right
that we're used to
they're
seeing
right
in
here.
A kitchen.
They're all right here.
Right there by the fireplace?
The sink is right behind you.
Yes, the sink is right behind me. This is called a dry sink because there's no plumbing. And you have a couple of pots on the crane that is your hot water supply.
And this is just hanging from the fireplace.
Yes, that's called a crane, that iron thing that swings in and out. And then down below there is a very small Dutch oven. I've made cornbread in it, and it tastes wonderful.
I'll bet.
Yeah. Okay, so back in pioneer days, kids did a lot of chores. And when I'm teaching kids in here, they don't realize how much the kids had to do, but then dads and moms were pretty busy too. Like, bring in firewood after it was split. Oh, I gotta do that. And over here, we have a table that would be used as a countertop today to prepare food on, plus various accoutrements, like there's a butter paddle and a butter press for the butter paddle's used to squeeze the buttermilk out of the butter. And the butter press is used to stamp this particular household's brand into the butter so that they could take it in to trade it. And over there is a big pot that get used at least twice a week. On Saturday nights, it's used for baths, and on Monday mornings, it's used for laundry.
It's just a big iron pot. And so how would you use this for a bath? It must have been like a spit bath kind of thing.
You put a little bit of a fire under it to warm it up and have water in there. And then on Saturday night, Dad steps in and takes a bath. And steps out, then Mom steps in, and then it goes from the oldest kid to the youngest.
So you actually put your feet in, stand there,
Dip
down with a cloth or something and get water. And
ladle or something like that.
Ladle, wash your body.
Wash your body with.
How about that?
And you've heard of the term, don't throw out the baby with the bath water?
Oh, yes, I have.
That would be the last kid that gets the bath. And that would be pretty soupy stuff.
Oh, yeah, poor baby.
Yeah. Okay, over on that wall right there, you see several things. And kids don't understand what any of this stuff is.
Yeah, well, we're looking at, there's some kind of a...
That's a scrub board.
Ribbed board.
I was going to say, this looks like for laundry.
Yeah, that's a scrub board. This is the paddle that would be used to stir the laundry when it was boiling. They boil laundry to get rid of vermin. And then you take it out and stick it on the scrub board. And then later on in the year, it'd be used to make stew for the harvest crew. Same pot,
they
same
pot. They would use for laundry, bathing, and to make stew.
Make stew for a big harvest crew. Because you got to remember, when you had a harvest crew in here, you had 40 or 50 people that were very hungry. They start working about 5 o'clock, and at noon, they want to eat. And then you'd be using this to make apple butter or applesauce with. And, of course, occasionally you have a bulky kid that needs a little bit of reminding that they need to do something.
I was going to ask you if there was a dual use for that or another use for that paddle.
It's a multi-use tool. And this is one of the things that gets the kids all the time is this rug beater. I tell them, that's the vacuum cleaner. And they go, huh?
They were the vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, they get to beat the dirt out of the rugs. You figure 5 to 7 months of muddy feet walking through a house, those rugs would get pretty darn dirty. So first spring weather that's nice, they'd go out over a rope and the kids would be whacking on them.
This rug beater, it looks like a big heart-shaped metal fly swatter kind of thing looking, yeah.
Now this hook gets them all because nobody knows what this is.
Yeah, it looks like some kind of fishing implement or something. It's about a... 5 foot tall, 6 foot tall, long hook with
take
a wooden
the
handle.
Clothes out of the boiling water. With that,
what this is to get Sunday dinner with. Huh?
Yeah.
Blank stares?
Yeah.
Okay, what usually the oldest daughter would be tasked with this job. After breakfast is cleaned up on Sunday, before church, she has to start preparing that bird for dinner. So she takes that thing out, that hook out, drops it on the ground, puts a bunch of chicken feet around, and here, chick, 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 chick. And as soon as one gets close enough, or the one that she wants gets close enough, chink, around the leg, and then she dispatches the bird and starts working on it.
Oh, my.
Yes. So that's basically a chicken catcher.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Would have never guessed that.
And that hook at the end is specially designed to fit around a chicken's leg. And
chicken leg, yeah, chicken foot, chicken leg. You just give it a jerk, and that gets a hold of them so you don't have to try to chase them down.
Wow, that's quite a device.
So food preparation, this is a really big kitchen, by the way.
Well,
it's very
down here on the floor, you have a lard bucket and two butter churns. The small one was built in Buena Vista in about 1850 or something like that. And the other one's a modern reproduction. And then if we go over that side... Every farmhouse had a secretary, and this is what a secretary looks like back then, where the farmer's...
A secretary is a piece of furniture,
yes,
not
it's
a
kind
person.
Kind of like a desk.
Yeah.
And it's what they kept all their bills and stuff in so that they could keep records of who owed who what. Because you got to remember, back in those days, a lot of stuff was done on barter. And somebody had... Say, I'll give you a pig in the spring if you give me 5 bushels of wheat. Such things as that. And that's how trading was done. And then we continue on here.
That looks like a high chair to me.
It is. That's a high chair.
A very nice one.
Yeah, and I think that thing will fold over to become kind of a little roller thing. I'm not sure about that, but that's okay. And here in the crib is... a very different bottle. There. This is a baby bottle. And you had the rubber nipple that went over the top and the groove in there for the cord. That's so the bottle wouldn't drop on the ground or get lost. That could be tied around a kid's wrist. It could be tied around a piece of furniture. It's kind of like the little ribbons that go on the
on your fingers.
No, not on the finger, but on the What's that thing called?
Oh, the pacifier.
Pacifier.
Yes.
Yeah, pacifier. So same idea.
Mm-hmm.
Then continuing on along here, you see a yoke. Over there, there's probably a bucket or two, and the yoke and the buckets would go together, and the kids would have a job after breakfast, after lunch, after dinner.
That was not a yoke for like oxen. That's a yoke for a person.
That's a person
put on
yoke.
Their shoulders.
They'd go down to the river, pick up water and bring it up and fill this barrel. And that was the water supply.
Now, does this barrel have some kind of a seal in the top? Or
well, if it was used regularly, it would be the wood would be soaked up.
Yeah,
and it wouldn't leak. But as it is, it gets used maybe twice a year and it leaks like a sieve.
Now, I've been in the kitchen, and I don't know how many times a year you do this, but I've been in this kitchen where there's been a fire and there's been cooking going on.
Yes, that's when there's reenactments going on. And I usually have, when we have students in here, I have a fire going on there just for atmosphere more than anything else.
So is there any particular time of the year that you do the reenactments?
Well, we'll have it. We'll have the whole reenactment thing going during the Halloween Trolley of Terror events that we put on. And then, of course, it'll be lit for the parlor tour in the Christmas time. And then, of course, we have a large tour or something during the winter when it's a little cold. It's really kind of nice. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. On the last Christmas parlor tour, we had about a three-year-old come in, looked at it and said, "Is that real?" So, you know, you think about the natural gas fireplaces we have today and the electric things, to have somebody come in, and the comment they always talk about, the parents will come in, is the smell. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, it's a wood fire. So John's very good about lighting those and getting them going and helping to show the pioneer life. I mean, the women spent half the day just fixing the meals.
I would think it was almost all day between the laundry and the different meals that you had to catch and prepare. Mm-hmm. It was pretty much all day.
Yeah. Well, people would cook for more than one day when they could. Mm. You know, it's just like leftovers from dinner last night. You can have that for lunch tomorrow.
So where's the refrigeration?
Frequently, it'd be just a big hole in the ground.
Root cellar.
Root cellar would be a good thing. Just a hole in the ground with a box set over it that you could lift things in and out. That would keep it cooler. It wasn't, you didn't have what we would term as refrigeration, per se.
No ice box yet.
Good possibility not, although some people might have got the idea to build an ice box, but that'd be one big bulky thing that wouldn't have a whole lot of room in it.
Yeah.
And then there's the transporting of ice. Mm-hmm. Where are you going to get it, and how are you going to get to where you are?
In fact, a pie chest, you know, used to think it was, I always thought, well, that's for pies, but actually a pie chest was a container with some holes on the side of it, usually a brass plate type thing, but it was designed for keeping your items in there. I mean, you had mice and flies,
right,
and everything else. So anything that you valued that from leftover from a meal or something, Sunday dinner, you would have put into that pie chest.
And you might have one pie in there. You might have one pie in there, and the rest of it would be leftovers.
That, and of course, you did a lot of jerky. You did a lot of drying of foods. You think about apples, the cherries, the Linn County maps, the taxation maps. They actually drew maps of what the farms looked like. All of the farms had orchards.
Yeah.
So you would have been drying the apples and the cherries, or else you would have made marmalade, apple butter, anything you could to preserve the foods over a long period of time.
Now, coming west, every wagon was required to have at least two guns. This particular gun is one that I
Look
built.
Look at that.
And it weighs about 8.5 pounds, about the same amount as a new baby. So when I have kids in here and I get somebody that's kind of a little bit rambunctious, I have him carry this thing the entire time he's in. He's usually the kid's very happy to put it down at the end of the tour. So this gun is rather typical. It's a 54 caliber muzzle loader. And I have taken two deer with it, and it does a fantastic job of putting them down.
You built this yourself?
I built this myself, yes.
Now, being a blacksmith by trade, that would be very helpful in regards to building a gun like this. Tell me about some of the other things as a blacksmith that you have constructed or built or repaired, specifically in regards to the Monteith Hauser.
Okay, these hooks that stuff are hanging from, I built those. That crane that's used over the fireplace that swings the pots in and out. I built that.
Now, did you use like old pictures to get the idea of what it should look like and function?
Yeah, I had a pretty decent idea of what it was when I started. And it was an interesting project in fitting it and making sure that everything is period correct on that particular item. Those are the main things that I've done in this house that you can see. In the back room there, there's a bunch of iron tent stakes that I built for the awning that goes up in the summer. Okay, here's one more item.
As he puts the gun down, you can hear it.
Thump. Yeah. All right, this is a flint and steel. Now, you got to remember, back before TV and radio and telephones, stories were told almost all the time. That's one form of education, is telling stories.
And entertainment.
And entertainment, yes. Now, this is a flint striker that I built years ago that looks like a baby dragon. And I use this to tell stories on starting fires because matches, 50 cents a box, a half day's wages for a lot of people, or maybe a full day's wages. So they might have a box of matches up on the mantle to impress people with, but for the most part, they still use a flint and steel. Maybe you catch the sound on this thing. I'll see if I can get a spark to strike.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he's good.
Yeah, nice. You've done that before, I could tell.
At least once. At least once. So that's the story of this area.
And with that, let's take you upstairs, and Patty Evans will talk a little bit about what we've got up there.
You're listening to a broadcast from the Monteith House here on Valley Talk today on 2nd Avenue Southwest. If you've never noticed it's there, when you go to the Albany Post Office, take a look across the street. Boom! There it is, that beautiful white two-story house. It was built in 1848, the first one of its kind here in Albany. And it's still here today, beautifully restored, and our broadcast is coming from the Monteith House today on Valley Talk. We were just listening to John Langford, the blacksmith. Thank you, John.
Yeah. And you Chet. Remember that this house is the oldest building in town, literally. This is the oldest building in town.
And so now Chet Hauser is going to take us up to meet Patty Evans, who will take us through the upstairs of the Monteith House.
I'm excited, Jeff. I've never been upstairs.
Neither have I.
I've always been here at the parlor tour, so I'm excited.
All right.
Look at the size of these stairs. Here we go.
First thing I notice is this staircase is very,
narrow.
Very narrow, but yet very solid.
Yes.
It's really well built. That almost feels like concrete stairs. It's so solid.
Well, and pioneer families would not have needed a large, grand stairway in this era. I mean, you know, once you got money and built the large Victorian homes, or if you've been back to see Monticello and that kind of thing, yes, you would have had the grand staircase you see. But this is a pioneer family. They wanted a roof over their heads. They needed something quick. It's interesting, John was just saying it's the oldest house. We had to have the chimney worked on, and the mason went under the house and was amazed there are round logs with the bark still on it.
Oh, my.
This house was laid out with timber and put on stone foundation to start with. So, yeah, it's what we did back then. We didn't have a concrete foundation. So with that, I want to introduce Patty Evans. She's one of our docents here in the house, and she's going to kind of talk you through what we have upstairs.
This is fun to have you here. I love being in the house and sharing it with people.
Well, thank you. The first thing I'm noticing
is
directly across from us, the wall, which is alongside the staircase as you come up. Is this original material here?
Yes.
And tell us what we're seeing.
It really is original. This is a wonderful wall. You can look through the plexiglass and actually see the hand-hewn lumber that was used for the house. And you see this beautiful wood, 16 feet. And there are places, I understand, in the house where the lumber is as wide as 15 inches across. But you see these beautiful planks of wood. And the first covering that would have been on them is this stained muslin that you can see. This is original muslin cloth that was put over to provide a place for wallpaper to be put on, but also some insulation. And as you see on the ceiling, there's muslin there to keep the droppings and bugs from falling through onto, you know, onto your heads. So, of course, when the bachelors lived here, they didn't care about wallpaper. But by the time Christine Monteith got here in 1854, it was a different question. Yes. So you can actually see on this wall the actual wallpaper that she put on, which there's a piece over here that has a little blue flower on it. That was the first layer of wallpaper that went up on the muslin. And then you can still see the color. And then a second layer is right in that same area that came on. I believe it was 1870 in that area. And then this more brown piece was 1890. So,
how about that?
And we have wallpaper on the walls up here now, which just is not original, but it gives you an idea of how they tried to fancy things up a little bit as the years went by. But the room over here at the top of the stairs is set up as the bachelor's chamber would have looked in 1850 when the Walter and Thomas and Sam were living in this house. It has muslin on the walls, and it has an old pioneer rope bed. So if you've never slept on ropes...
Look at this bed. It's sort of sunken in.
Oh, my goodness.
It's got ropes on it that have to be tightened, of course, because you get enough children or bachelors in that bed, they're going to stretch out the rope, so you have to tighten it up. And it's going to have a feather or straw-ticked mattress that's probably full of bugs. And so that's why Pioneer Mama's always said, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite.
And if they do, bite them back. Oh, that's what my mom said.
And the chamber pot under the bed, because there was an outhouse, but nothing inside. And the other part of the bathroom is over here on one of our Oregon Trail trunks that is the pitcher and the bowl where you wash your face and a piece of lye soap that... All-purpose cleaner, you know, brush your teeth, wash your clothes, wash the floor, wash everything.
Now, that water for the pitcher and bowl up here, would that have come from the main water supply downstairs?
Yes, probably. Yeah. Yes, probably would. Evan, probably one of the kids later was in charge of emptying chamber pots and bringing up water, and so they were the source of power for that. And then the clothes would have been kept in these old trunks that would have come on over the Oregon Trail in the earliest days. This was their furniture.
I was going to say, I don't see any actual, besides the bed itself, and there's a chair, I don't see any what we would call furniture, really. There's just a trunk for the clothes and some other trunks here stacked up.
Yeah, and a pioneer bed like this would have been made right here on the spot. It wouldn't have been something that they shipped in. And then the keg that probably had nails or something like that becomes a good night table. So very efficient, very functional for these bachelors who lived in this room.
And everything had multi-purpose.
That's right. Multi-purpose across the board. Walls have pegs on them so that you can hang your clothes up there, your one extra jacket. Three pairs of clothes they would have, one to wear every day and one when you get the other ones in the wash, and then a Sunday best. Yeah.
Very good. Wore those once a week.
That's right.
Now, I see in the ceiling that there is some kind of looks like an access to the attic. Was this there originally, or is that added in? Do you know, Chet?
I think that was original, and when we had this re-roofed a couple of years ago, the original boards were up there, and we had to replace a bunch of them. They were just dry rotted.
Sure.
But yeah, that would have been the entrance they would have used to get up into the attic.
Now, as we go down the hall, we go from the bachelor's quarter to the Monteith couple, Thomas and Christine's, what their bedroom would have looked like, and... I don't know if anybody's told you the story about Thomas and Christine.
Why don't you explain how Thomas had to go back and pick Christine up?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's, you know, I think Walter and Thomas were pretty much bachelors, and Sam too, but they got out here. They were heading over the Oregon Trail and had a stop off in Iowa, where Thomas fell in love. I mean, I think it must have been first sight with Christine Dunbar, who was 15. And, you know, for some strange reason, her daddy was not inclined to let her just marry up at that time and come across the Oregon Trail with three bachelors, you know. So it was a different kind of world. So he said, no, you go out, you build your town, you come back. And so 7 years, good biblical number for Thomas. He came out here and started building this house and set up the town, went back 7 years later, married Christine, and they went to New York City on a honeymoon and bought this furniture that you see in this room.
This is their original furniture.
This is their honeymoon furniture that got put on a ship. Beautiful, beautiful wood furniture with marble tops, and some of their goods. There's a pair of Christine's gloves here, and so and pictures.
Wow, look at that.
The quilt on the bed has a blue pattern on it. It was made on the Oregon Trail in 1851. So a quilt like that would have been on this little bed. And we just have a real sense of what a room in probably 1860 would have looked like. So people have to come and see it.
And it's so well preserved. Everything is in such perfect condition. It doesn't look like it's that old.
Yes.
It's beautiful.
You would think it was a reproduction or something, but it isn't. This is the furniture that went on the ship, went around the Horn, and up the coast, across the Columbia River, down the Willamette, to this place, to this house.
We're so fortunate to be able to enjoy it today.
Are these pictures of the couple on the wall there?
This is Thomas, and this is Christine over here, and a couple of their children. And then in the corner is, I believe, a nephew. Is not one of the children.
I see.
The story goes, but
how about those boots or shoes? Which would you call them?
Those are boots. Yes, those are ladies' boots, and I wouldn't want to wear them. They're very narrow and very pointy, and probably not that comfortable.
I've heard stories. People were smaller in general back then.
That's what I've heard, too.
Yeah.
You know,
so that would explain those stinky.
Look at the size of the mattress there.
Yes.
Yeah. So they were really small or really
it's less than a double bed, you know. I mean, it is. It's quite long, though.
I get the impression, though, Patty, that this would have been considered a pretty fancy room for its
indeed.
Time.
Yes. This kind of shows that at this point the Montes had wealth and were upper class here in this home. Yeah. So you want
to. It's a very big room.
It is.
All the rooms are ample size.
I just have to point out on the bed is a beautiful house coat.
Yes.
And in the 1948 historical interviews and things he did with the granddaughter, she commented that Grandma was known for the scandalous thing that she used to wear her house coat until at least noon.
Yes.
What about that? Is that a hair clip up there?
A hair comb. Yes. You know, it's a Victorian lady needs to keep her hair up, and also it's nice to keep it off your neck when you're keeping house, and so you wrap that up and put that comb in.
I see.
Would have been one that she would have worn much like that. Across the hall, we have what would have actually been their bedroom. This furniture would have been in here.
In this room.
In this room, which is a much bigger room. Back in the bachelor days, the McConnell family lived in this room with three children. And so it's plenty big for that amount of people. And now we have this exhibit room so people can see the involvement in the community that the Monteiths had, the churches that they helped establish, and the business, and their involvement in politics and government is all here, along with Monteith furniture. Much of this is original Monteith furniture, and some of it is just of the proper period. So there's other things. I like the story of this. A drum over here. This is a Civil War drum. And it was a Monteith nephew that was in the Civil War. He got moved up to clerk, and so he sent the drum home, packed with goods, and said, keep this drum, it's a good one. But trouble is, he didn't come home from the Civil War. He died of disease during the war, as many did. But the drum is here for us to see. And then Thomas, a replica of Thomas Monteith's Oregon militia uniform. His sword is over the mantle downstairs, which just thrills the children when they come and to see the actual sword that he had with his dress uniform. So many good things for people to see. The pictures of the family and the farm implements that would have been used.
And look at the little shoes over there in the corner, the children's shoes.
I want to talk briefly about some of the fundraising efforts. We would really like to encourage people to come to the various tours. We derive a lot of the money we need for operating costs. The house has to have insurance. We have to have a telephone and security system and everything else. So we do that through the fundraisers. The Trolley of Terror comes up in October. We have the city trolley, and we take you around and talk about many of the ghost stories in these various old Victorian homes, unexplained things that just have occurred and still happen today. Of course, we have the horse-drawn carriage, the caroling in December. I had a lady the other day say, you know, I've never been on it, but I love to hear the clip-clop, clip-clop as the horses go by my house. So it's truly a bygone era. We do the tours in the house here. We do not charge admission, but we love to take donations. So we're one of those few museums that's not going to hit you when you first come in the door, but we certainly would appreciate any donations for that. And then, of course, I talked earlier about the parlor tour coming up at Christmas. So please come on down and see us. We have a docent here Wednesday through Saturday, 12 to 4. And if you want to set up a tour of any kind, the phone number is outside on the fence. You can call Rebecca down at the Albany Visitors Association. So thank you for coming to the Monteith House. I hope we've answered some questions you might have had. I hope you've heard some things that make you curious enough to come on down and see us.